Greetings, Sirenauts, and welcome to Observations with me, your host, Sovereign Sire. I'm brought to you by the Bon Vivants and Ne'er-Do-Wells at Julieland.com. And as always, I'm joined by Mr. Avery, who is snickering at me and kerfuffled over there.
I know. Good morning.
I was using big words, I know.
I know.
I was getting
way over my head.
I was getting very exotic. En français.
Oui.
Today, my guest is Baron Vaughn.
What it is, yeah.
Who are you? Who the fuck are you?
Oh, that question I ask myself every morning in the bathroom mirror.
When you look in the mirror.
Gee, I haven't answered it yet, but now on a podcast for you? Okay. I'm me. I was me, I'll be me. I am, you want me to say what I do?
Where are you from? Let's start there.
Small town, Las Vegas, Nevada.
Okay.
Yeah.
You were born and raised there.
I was born in New Mexico.
Okay.
In a very small town called Portales.
All right.
Then moved to a smaller town called Tucumcari.
Okay.
Then ended up in Las Vegas about age 7-ish.
Okay.
And then I was there until I went to college.
Where'd you go to college at?
Boston University.
And were you always funny?
Yeah, I think that my parents used to say a problem, problematic, but I believe I was funny. Yeah.
My parents call me a smart ass.
A smart ass?
Yeah, that's what they always said. You're such a smart ass.
Well, but they were saying it in like that manner, like trying to put you down.
Oh, totally.
Like, stop being a smart ass.
Yeah, pretty much.
Mine just said stop it. They didn't have time for the smart ass part.
Too much sugar.
Exactly.
So what was your major in college?
Theater.
Okay, so you knew pretty early on that you wanted to be a performer?
Yeah, because I was attracted to comedy at a young age. You know, I was in New Mexico. It was my great-grandparents that I was raised by.
Okay.
And so I was on a steady stream of Nick at Night television.
Gotcha.
And just watching black and white TV like
what
Patty Duke and Dobie Gillis. And, you know, I think I really loved Mr. Ed.
Me too.
Yeah.
Because it's like you're a kid. It's a talking horse.
Yeah, it's
you're
a talking like, horse. And even when I heard, oh, you know, they put peanut butter on that horse's mouth, I was like, even better. Even right. That horse was getting a sweet snack. That's right. Why it looks so happy in every single show.
Right. A horse.
No, but
is
I remember,
horse.
Like, yeah, I was obsessed with that show because
it was like a talking horse.
Yeah, and it was just kind of.
But yeah, that's what I kind of grew up on. And when I saw Sammy Davis Jr., I want to say on Patty Duke, I was so used to seeing white people that when I saw a black person, I was like, we did it. Like it was the 60s. That's exactly right. How I reacted.
You experienced it all in like the span of like
I was
3 years.
5 years old.
Yeah,
we're
like,
on television.
Right.
And then I moved on to 227 and Amen. But I watched.
I remember these shows.
Yeah. 227, you know, Jeffersons, etc. Golden Girls. My great grandparents love the Golden Girls. But I was attracted to comedy on those shows too, like, you know, Saturday Night Live, the original 5 years.
Uh-huh.
SCTV, Laughing, you know,
Monty Python at all?
Not Monty Python until later. But I was SNL, SCTV, Laughing, and Carol Burnett show at the beginning.
Carol Burnett was the best.
I think a really I still don't think she gets enough credit.
Oh.
In my personal
opinion. No,
so
I agree.
How is it like, so you're on the show Grace and Frankie?
Yes.
How is it being like with Jane Fonda and Lily Tomlin? Because you must have grown up watching
Lily
her.
Tomlin is because she was on Laughing.
Yeah.
And she was a particular hero of mine and I loved her characters.
So that must be really surreal to walk in and be on a show with her.
It is, especially because it's like, it's almost like, I hate to say this word because it's cheesy, it's like I manifested it.
No, I feel that way all the time with stuff. Like, things will happen in my life, and I'm like, am I playing a video game?
Exactly.
It's like, it's just like a weird, like...
Well, I just remember seeing an article that they were developing the show at Netflix, and seeing that Jane Fonda and Lily Tomlin were on it, and I was like, wow, Lily Tomlin might be the spiritual mother I need right now.
And now she plays your
mother. Yeah, later, she's playing my mother. Yeah.
So what was your journey? So, how long were you out of college before you... Like, what was your journey to get here in terms of, did you start out doing stand-up? Were you always kind of minded towards trying
to
get
on this? Went down La Brea or Highland?
Yeah. Well, I went down Highland. Down to the...
Well, I mean, I know you Ubered here, but...
Yeah. I Uber. I don't have a car anymore. It's not necessarily an intentional choice, but turning out to be an interesting lifestyle thing.
I did Uber for 4 months because I totaled my car on Christmas Eve. And then... But I was so... Like, I was so... Uber made it so easy that I didn't get a new car till May.
Yeah, you know, somebody did a study apparently that it costs the same or even less to take Uber and Lyft everywhere than it costs to have a car when you have, like, you know, hidden fees and tickets and registration and shit.
I think it's one of the greatest inventions ever.
Uber?
Yeah.
So it's it's a good product.
Yeah, it really
it's
is.
A billion-dollar industry as far as I know.
I mean, it's definitely like I was just a friend, you know, like a friend's like, I'm having a party. I want to come out and get drunk. And I was like, oh, it's cool because I can just like, oh, yeah, I'll Uber over.
Because I'm not driving.
Yeah, like I don't have to worry about like.
That was the best thing about New York.
Yeah. Exactly.
Stagger out of a club and into a cab and home.
Did you ever live in
subway.
New York?
I did. I was in New York for 8 years after Boston.
Okay.
So, I mean, basically, I was attracted to performance, went to school.
as is
required by law.
Right.
And then when I was getting to high school, I was in eighth grade, and I was always a good reader. Because mm-hmm. my grandmother taught me how to write cursive when I was like kindergarten, and I could read off the page, making no mistakes. And it got to the point where I would do voices for characters and stuff.
Right.
So in eighth grade, people were like, hey, you should go to that performing arts high school we got here in Las Vegas. I was like, there's a performing arts high school. They're like, yeah, see that voice you did right there? That's exactly how I should be there. What are you talking about, Jack? Mm-hmm. And so they kind of pushed me towards the library.
I went to a performing arts high school as well.
Did you? Which one?
Yeah, I went to Roosevelt School of the Performing Arts.
Where's that?
It's in California. It's in Central California.
Oh, okay. What city?
Fresno. It's like, it's one of like the biggest
I've
performing arts high schools.
I've never heard of Fresno. I'm joking.
They have
a
horrible football team.
No, I actually think that I met some kids from that high school once.
It's a very... Audra McDonald came out of there.
Yeah,
like,
when
it's,
I...
So it's like one of the best performing arts schools in the country.
That's I had heard of it because there's a couple. There's that one. There's NOCA, which I think is in New Orleans, I remember hearing about.
And there's like Interlochen in Michigan.
Interlochen, yeah. Yeah, and why do I always want to say Idlewild, but that's not right. I feel like there's one called that, but that's definitely not it. Regardless, I met some kids from that high school once when I visited Juilliard. Didn't get in, but I did. They did let me in the doors.
So you were kind of like an academic performer, because I was like the same way, where it's like the dream was like, oh, you go to performing arts high school, and then you like try to go to like Juilliard, or like there's definitely like almost, I would say, like a performance nerd, where it's like your idea is you're going to go into like this sort of scholarship
where
route.
It's essentially
where
it's essentially like these are the Ivy Leagues of performing.
Yes, you're going to go to prestige schools.
Yeah, prestige schools. And essentially, that is what I ended up doing, because Boston University at the time that I went was supposedly one of the quote-unquote top three. I'm doing quotation mark
like
fingers.
Very frantically. And you know, if you do this in ASL, American Sign Language, that means fucking.
Oh, does it?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because it looks like two bug antennae touching. And isn't that true?
Dick, asshole, orgasm, fucking, horny.
And you're fluent in sign language?
I just know a little bit.
That's true. It's always the dirty words that everybody wants to know first.
Yeah.
What the heck was I talking about? I totally lost my place.
I want to know what in New York. What did you do in New York? Did you perform there?
No, so you went to Boston University.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, I went to this performing arts high school and then got serious about acting, then went to BU, and it was at BU that I started doing stand-up. Because the whole reason I was attracted to acting in the first place was because of stand-up.
Yeah.
Because I watched a lot of stand-up when I was in high school, a lot of like those sketch shows, and that led me to like watching stand-up. And I guess I went, people on the stage saying things, that's the same thing as theater. Right. So I started pursuing theater, but it was in Boston where I started, in theater school, where I started doing stand-up about my sophomore, junior year-ish.
Who was doing comedy in Boston at that time? Like, who were you looking up to? Like, who were the kind of, who were like the sort of grand,
it's interesting because it's like,
Boston at that time.
I had a lot of influences that I was coming to stand-up with.
Okay.
Which were outside of just the Boston scene.
Right.
And I got to find out that Boston does have an interesting scene.
So who were like the big people at that time, like when you first kind of got up there?
You know,
or what
actually...
I guess what I'm saying is like, what was doing well? Like, what was the style of comedy that was kind of...
Well, you know, Boston had this... It had two very distinct sides, as the city does, where it has this really blue-collar, like, everyday guy sort of thing, and then fucking Harvard and MIT. Right. So it's like when you go to a comedy club, you're going to have the dudes who are like, yeah, I fucking was driving trucks all day. And the other guy's like, I was contemplating physics the other night, like on the same show.
On the same circuit?
On the same circuit. So it's like in the same kind of clubs. So there's this premium on really smart comedy in Boston because there's clubs around like Harvard, like a lot of Harvard and MIT students try to do stand-up.
Which is interesting to me.
Yeah, and a lot of them become stand-ups.
Yeah.
Like... the first person I can think of off the top of my head is Dan Mintz. You know Dan Mintz at all?
No.
He's one of the voices on Bob's Burgers. You watch Bob's Burgers at
Yes,
all?
Yes.
He's the voice of the daughter with the glasses.
Oh, yeah,
he's
Tina.
He's got that really high... Yeah, that voice. He went to Harvard.
Well, no, like...
And
like
he started doing
that...
stand-up when he was at Harvard, and now he became a comedy writer and a comedy voice.
Well, that's the thing is I was surprised by that there was... when I first started meeting comedians, I think I talked about this with Sarah, where it's like the idea, or maybe it was Hampton, but it was like that there's an actual school of comedy writers that come like out of Harvard. And like, it's just, it's
the Lampoon.
It's just, just kind of like incongruous, like to, for me, like, never associated, like that there's like,
it's not your world.
There's a track that in which like comedy writers are coming out of Ivy League schools.
Right. And but it's hard to get into comedy writing sometimes if you didn't come out of those schools.
The funny part, because I'm the oldest here by far.
No.
Way far.
I'm 86. It's just that black don't crack.
I was going to say, very spry.
I'm 90. But it's weird is that growing up, when I was a kid, there was all that stuff. I grew up with a lot of that stuff. I grew up with a lot of comedy to begin with, but I grew up knowing about Harvard. Of course, we all grew up with, you know, the Lampoon stuff or whatever.
Yeah.
A lot of comedy. I was around a lot. So, you know, for me, it's like normal to see. It's just now there's just more people wanting to do it.
Yeah.
You know, there's just more, and there's more clubs than ever before. There's like everything in life. There's just more of everything.
There is. But also the thing about stand-up is that everyone comes to it from a different place.
Oh, totally.
Like it's a interesting catch-all sort of industry. Mm-hmm. Where people have performed, you know, and pursued performance or theater, or even went to Harvard and got lampooned and like, I'm a stand-up. Or people were just, hey, you're funny, you should tell jokes. And then they become a huge star as well 20 years later.
Right.
And they were just like a copy machine repair guy who just was funny around the office. Someone's like, hey, you should do stand-up. And then 20 years later, that's, you know, Patrice O'Neill or somebody. It's not Patrice O'Neill.
Yeah. I mean, like my roommate Desi is, you know, never had like a big formal education in terms of that kind of stuff, but she's an incredibly gifted comedy writer and has now kind of gotten all of these opportunities.
Oh, great.
Kind of because of Twitter and things like that, where it's like it kind of gave her this platform in which.
And Twitter,
I mean,
is
obviously
an interesting
that was followed up by talent.
Too,
you know what I mean? It was like people investigated her because of the Twitter, and of course she is also Twitter's brilliant.
Twitter is an online writing packet.
Yeah.
I know plenty of people who've gotten freaking jobs because they have this amount of followers, and you look at like their top tweets and it's like, these are just great jokes. Like this person, if this person could write this when they're just like farting in their underwear having breakfast, imagine what they'll do if I'm paying them, huh?
Right. But yeah, I mean, that's a lot of I'm also finding that a lot of like writing and stuff like that just comes from people know each other. They, you know, like
there's a community.
It's not what you know, it's who you know.
And sometimes it's neither.
it's not who you know. It's who
sometimes
you blow.
Someone's got some muscle behind them saying.
How long were you?
Contract.
How long were you? Yep. So you're in Boston. You're going to college. You're performing.
Yep.
How long before you were making money doing just acting in comedy?
Right out of college.
Fuck you.
Right out of college, I right out of college, I booked a Broadway play.
That's amazing.
And I was
amazing.
I'm very good. No, I'm joking. I got to do this prestigious theater festival called Williamstown Theater Festival. And there I got to audition for a play that was at the Manhattan Theater Club called Drowning Crow.
Okay.
Which is an all-black adaptation of The Seagull. You guys know The Seagull at all?
Mm-mm. I do.
You do?
I've heard of it.
It's an old Russian play by Anton Chekhov. Okay. And then this woman, Regina King. Nope, that's not right. Ooh. I can't remember her name exactly because Regina King is a completely different actress.
I was going to say
Regina Taylor. Okay, I'm messing all of it up. I'll fact check it later. She wrote this all-black adaptation of it, which I got to do. But then I did that for like 3 months and then was completely broke. So I got a job on Broadway right away, but then I was like, oh, I don't have an agent and all that shit. And then I was just like working at a law firm.
Okay, so how long were you doing that? I mean, like, how long before you were able to kind of comfortably be, not comfortably, but...
Well, you know, I worked at the law firm for a year and a half, and then I was fortunate enough to book a commercial and then ended up quitting, and that was about 25.
Okay.
So it's like, I got into it pretty early, but then I also never really hit... I didn't hit a stride until about a couple years ago.
Okay.
So it's like been 10, it was like 10 years of like back and forth.
So it's a 10 year overnight sensation.
Yeah, essentially. Yeah. Where it's like I got in a Broadway play. I didn't know how to play the game after that. I didn't know how to parlay that in any other work.
Right.
But I luckily got like a commercial agent out of it. Then I was working at a law firm. Then I booked a commercial. And then I started booking a few commercials.
What was the commercial for?
The first commercial I booked was for AOL, actually. Okay. It was back when AOL had commercials.
And thanks to your commercial, where America, they are today?
Today.
Well, I mean,
America Offline.
That's exactly. Like when I had Sarah on, that her first job was hosting a show for AOL. And I was like, what?
Oh, yeah, like AOL was, web. Yeah, yeah. Like, and I've known Sarah for a long time as well.
Isn't she incredible?
I think she's the bomb diggity.
Yeah, I think she's just like an amazing human being.
Right.
Like,
she is. And we just did a show the other night, and she killed it softly, with her words, and she's one of the people I kind of started out with when I was in New York, because I was in Boston and there was a kind of a group of people that I was becoming close with, namely this guy Mike Kaplan, who's still around.
Mm-hmm. I think someone was just like suggested I follow him, and was like,
MYQ.
You gotta get into this. He has
a master's in linguistics, so that's the kind of humor he brings.
Yeah, yeah. Even his Twitter is very much like that kind of word.
It's very much like, and this is how he talks, and that's how he talks.
Right.
But I've known that guy for 14 freaking years.
Wow.
So it's like, then I got to New York, and I had this interesting, weird, simultaneous thing where it's like my acting career was going okay, but my comedy career was only at the beginning of it. Because I would show up to these commercial auditions, and stand-up comics who had been doing comedy for 10 years that had took them 10 years to get a commercial agent were looking at me like, what the hell? Didn't this guy just start doing stand-up yesterday? But they didn't know that I had this acting career
as well.
So there was this weird schism where there was a chasm between my acting and between my stand-up. And then my stand-up started to take over. Once I started booking commercials, I was able to support myself.
What do you like better?
And then do stand-up.
Why?
Because it is the all total, all complete me-ness.
So like the control, like the creative control of it? Like
it's not even just the creative control, is that it's like I am the one who is so exposed. I am the one who is vulnerable. I am the one who is talking. I am the one who is moving. And I am the one who has you in my hand to take you on whatever intergalactic journey I so desire.
And what kind of material do you do? Would like not are you alternative or whatever, but like what kind of topics or subjects seem to
Well, I am alternative, like, because it's like I have this weird thing where I'm this black comedian that is not a black comedian.
You're black?
Yeah.
Oh my very. God.
Like Dolezal style.
I'm totally colorblind, so I was like,
"Oh, you don't see color? That's horrible."
I thought that toaster was my mom for like 2 years.
That's a completely different problem. But I can see why you might confuse that for colorblindness. It might be a symptom. Might be a symptom of that completely different problem.
I have problems with object permanence as well.
Oh.
Attachment disorders. But yeah, I don't see
but
color.
But face and race blindness. Perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is your wife a hat? the point of that is that I didn't go about it in the way that a lot of black comics do, because I didn't do like black rooms.
Chocolate Sundays.
Yeah, I didn't do Chocolate Sunday. I didn't do like the kind of urban, more Chitlin kind of circuit thing.
Chitlin?
And so, Chitlin. Do you know what Chitlins are?
I didn't realize there was a circuit.
It used to be called the Chitlin Circuit.
It is a delicious food item.
It's not really delicious.
Oh.
You have to drown it in all sorts of spices for it to not be pig intestines.
Tasty.
Ironically, like culturally speaking, I was raised eating a lot of stuff like that.
Oh, really?
My best friend from the time I was like a little kid was black, and I used to, because I was actually kind of like a latchkey kid.
Yeah.
But her mom and dad were like on it. So like I actually ended up eating there all the time. Like I ended
and
up eating.
And they made soul food a lot?
Yeah. So like it was just something that was horrible. Just like always in the palate. But then also the town I grew up in was predominantly Hispanic. So a lot of things like menudo and things like. So like to me, those food items aren't that crazy. It's not that I love
like
them
shit.
Or seek them out now. But because I just always had them around, like they're not crazy to me. I'm like, yeah, I'm sure.
They are cultural delights.
I grew up on it. I grew up on it.
I'm not saying I go to soul food joints now and like seek that shit out. I'm just saying.
No, I'm just saying that soul food is slave food. Like when it comes down to it, it's like we got the leftovers. Let's spice them to hell and make them something.
Make it somewhat edible. Yeah.
And that's why we have high cholesterol problems.
Yeah.
But
yeah, diabetes and cholesterol, like huge problems.
Sickle cell. It doesn't really come from food.
Not
really a diet thing.
No, but most of my friends, by the time we were in high school and college, most of my friends had like diabetes or like different kinds of issues like that.
I believe it's pronounced diabetes.
Diabetes.
Yeah.
Diabetes.
I only knew one kid in
school. But it was like from like either from like all like the lard and like
diabetes.
The
Oh, okay. That was like, I'm sorry. You said I only knew one kid in school growing up, and I was like, wait a minute.
But no, I just
Richard just gave us a really delicate gem from his childhood here.
Oh, we don't want to go there. But no, it just made me realize that growing up, that I don't think I had an issue.
Here's the end of that sentence. You only knew one kid growing up, with diabetes, that you were aware of. That's the end of the sentence.
That's true.
That you were aware of.
True.
Kids don't go around advertising their diabetes. True. Just kind of like, hey guys, who's up for some insulin? Right. Are you guys insulin or outsulin?
I'm just thinking. I don't know. It's this weird thing.
Well, I mean, the thing is too. Like a lot of the diet. Especially like in Hispanic culture, everything's cooked in lard. You know what I mean? Like that. Lots if you're doing it the real way, it's like everything's cooked in lard.
Every food reveals the culture. Like it reveals the history of that culture. It's like, okay, well they had only these things,
right?
And they had to boil them and then put this on it and stuff like that.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Are we right?
Just watch Anthony Bourdain every Sunday.
That's right.
Oh, that's
he ain't got no reservation. And also, no borders.
Exactly.
And also, I don't know what else he has none of, but he don't have them. So. He's Bourdain in the membrane. So what was I saying?
So you weren't on the Chitlin Circuit.
Yeah, no.
I can't believe that's a sentence I just said.
The Chitlin Circuit.
I hope no one isolates that.
The Chitlin Circuit, I mean, it's a slang term for a circuit that was happening, you know, like all the way back to Jim Crow South, to segregation, where it was like black performers had to do a certain thing.
So you kind of like went away from that. Sort of.
Yeah, I mean, just essentially I'm saying that like I wasn't doing all black rooms.
Right.
As I wasn't doing a system that had been prescribed to me.
But was that conscious?
Or
was
it just no, it just wasn't conscious.
It just kind of worked out
that way. Yeah, it just kind of worked out that way because it's like I came, first of all, I was in theater school. Not a lot of black people in theater school, contrary to popular belief. So it's like, if you're like, theater schools? What are they learning over there? Shakespeare? Must be tons of African Americans. Exactly. You know how they feel about Shakespeare.
Yeah.
But it's like, so I was always the only one, in a sense, like the only black kid into this and the only black kid into that. And so it was like
What's that like?
Are you actually asking?
Yeah, I'm asking. Like, what is that? What's that like?
It's you know, if you walk into a room and it makes you very, very conscious about race. Because, you know, I was just thinking about this the other day. Like, I realized that my family didn't talk about race growing up. It's because we didn't talk.
Right.
We didn't talk about anything. Yeah. So it's like, it's not even that it was avoided. It's just that no one, I didn't even know where my mom was born, like where she was from. I didn't know my grandma's age, like things that are simple.
Nobody just
that most people know. It's like, we just didn't talk about anything. So I didn't learn about racism from the experiences of my mother and my grandmother and my great grandparents, but more just from being black and then being like, oh, this is what people think about me.
Kind of like on the job training.
On the job, yeah. I hit the ground running for my life.
Exactly.
But there's some cops out tonight.
It's like, I know exactly what you're saying because I kind of grew up.
I mean, but there's kind of like a beauty in sort of ignorance, like when you don't know.
In a sense, but it's like
when you don't know you're supposed to be different, you kind of like walk in. Like I went to a fairly competitive writing program that for poetry, where the average age of the student was like 35, and they were usually men, and like I walked in and I was like very young and female. I just didn't know. I just didn't know that I was like not supposed
unique
to be there.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's like that thing where it's like, so you kind of walk in and you're just like, I didn't realize that like women weren't supposed to be able to like write good, compelling stuff. Like I didn't know that. Like, so I just walked in like, I'm going to.
But then you're being treated as if that's the case, even though you've been accepted into.
Well, yeah, there's times when it's like, why is it so hard for me to fit in? And someone would be like, did you notice that there is something you have that like everyone else in that workshop did not have? Titties. like you know, it's like someone pointing out like, did you happen to notice that there's something physically very different about you versus everyone else sitting
well
in the
because
workshop?
you
like, oh, okay.
You live your life through your eyes,
yeah,
and that's what you have always had and who you have always been. And then when people start to treat you differently for something that you're like, but I'm me, they're saying, right. No, but you're different from normal. And you're like, but no, I'm not. I've always been normal to me. No, but you're different from normal. And that's in your head. Then when you're the only person like you in a room, that's what tokenism is.
Right.
Is that everyone's kind of putting you in a box that you didn't ask to be in, assuming that that's where you want to be because they don't have to be there.
So do you think that, do you think you were able, like, the reason you were able to kind of avoid that was because, like you said, you're more of an alternative comic?
Oh, I don't think I've avoided it. I don't think I've avoided it. It's just that I've had to exist in the way that I existed. Like, I came out of the theater. I have a very theatrical.
I can tell.
I have a very theatrical style. Well, thank you. I mean, I try. I have a very theatrical style. I'm verbose. You know, I speak quickly.
Right.
And I've been told, and it's weird to say because it's like, it's hard to say, like, I'm a this and I'm a that, but it's because I'm inside my own body. So I don't know what's, when people say, like, you're really overwhelming, I'm like, am I? I didn't even, you're really intense. I'm not trying to be intense. So it's, but when people are putting that on you, it makes you conscious of, I guess I'm intense. I didn't even know. I guess I have to be less intense, whatever that means.
Right, right.
So it's like, but then also coming out of a theater background, and then getting to New York, and really what I started doing stand-ups. When I started doing the stand-ups in New York, mm-hmm. I did this thing called bringer shows. Do you guys know what bringer shows are?
No.
It is when you are a beginning comedian. This is, I'm sorry, this is getting so inside baseball. There are three opportunities for you to get stage time. Open mics, barkers, and bringers. Open mics are exactly what they are. They're open mics. And if you're, if you want to do stand-up, the best advice I have for you, listener, is to go to an open mic that is not specifically a stand-up comedy open mic, that has poetry, that has music, because then you're going to stick out and you're going to have an audience that isn't doing the same art form as you, judging you by their own standards, whereas at an open mic for comedy, people are just looking at their notes.
Right.
Number two, Barker's in New York especially, you're a human pop-up ad. You're standing in Times Square going, hey, you like comedy? You guys like comics from HBO, Comedy Central? We got comics from, and you're handing out flyers to a club that's around the...
Oh, that asshole. Yeah, I lived in New York for a minute.
There you go.
That asshole.
You're handing out flyers for a club that's around the corner. Okay. And I hated that because I hated getting in people's face.
Yeah.
But you do it for stage time. They make you stand out in the street sometimes... You know, I was going to say sometimes in the snow. They make you stand out in the street for hours in order to do 5 minutes of jokes that you could have been working on instead of being out there barking at people.
I love it, though.
What do you love?
I just love the fact that you have to pay your dues.
No, no, you do have to pay your dues.
And I love that.
That's
exactly.
And I chose to pay my dues with bringers, which in a sense are a little bit more humiliating than barkers. Because barkers, you're at least doing it strangers. Bringers are, the comedy club has a night that they've given to an independent producer, usually a comedian, who has guaranteed this club that they will have this many people paying for tickets this night. And they pass those savings to you, the comedian. You know what? If you bring 8 people, I will give you 8 minutes. So you have to beg and fight and cajole your friends who just got out of college and don't have $10, $15 to pay for a cover and $10, $15 to pay for two watered down drinks.
And they've heard all your shit.
And they've heard all your shit. And they go, can we just take a walk in the park and you be funny? Like, no, I need to get up in front of these motherfuckers. No, but I already... Are you going to do something different than you did last time? No, because this is literally the only stage time I get. Fucker. And then they promise you, I'll be there. And then you're outside in front of the dam. Still, like, where are my people? I've only got 5 people on the list. It's like, you only had 5 people tonight, so you can't go up. But there's 5 people here. Yeah, but it's guarantees for 8. Sorry, bro.
I know.
And then my friends are like, I just paid money and you didn't go up? I'm never doing this again. But I need you. That's where I chose to do my thing. Where do we get on that tangent?
So that must be like a weird psychological profile right there. Like, what can we tell? How can we profile you from, like, this is how you chose to... So you prefer to exploit the people close to you rather than strangers. So.
And those people are now not your friends.
Yeah. Like, so beware.
And
beware, comedian.
You came from a family of people that didn't talk.
I am creating such a beautiful dating profile right now.
So you were doing bringers.
Yeah, but that put me in the clubs more than it put me in, like, the open mics, and put me in just kind of I got used to being in front of mixed race audiences.
Right.
Which is how I grew up. You know, I mean, in New Mexico it was like black people, white people, Latinos, and Native Americans, because we still have Native Americans. And then I moved to Vegas and it was black people, Latin people. And then Asian Americans. Usually I was mostly around, like, Filipinos and Vietnamese. So I grew up around, like, a lot of different people. And having to kind of translate blackness to my friend from Vietnam, Tony Tran, who is now translating being Vietnamese to me. And, like, oh, okay. So we're reaching across the aisle, or at least just kind of getting this. So I wasn't in a monolithic place. So when I go up in front of an audience that is one thing, you know, we're all black, we're all white, we're all hipsters. If they all kind of have a self-identified, unspoken commonality, I tank.
What do people, what's the universal thing that gets laughed?
The universal
thing? Like, where
you,
if you could go, like, if you walk into any audience.
You mean my
like, if you're
sitting
there in your act and you walk into, like, any audience, is there one thing that you know, like, will kind of everyone relates to? Like, everyone, is there, like, kind of like a go-to thing where, like, when in doubt, fucking do the dick joke or whatever? Like,
not really, really. It's just that I can sing and I can beatbox. So okay. It's like if I, and I hate when I go to this place because I feel like I'm pandering, but I have a lot of jokes about music and a lot of jokes in which I sing.
Okay.
And so usually, especially if I'm in the group of 30s to 40s, I can get a response on like a bunch of jokes I have about like Disney cartoon theme songs.
Okay.
But I try to make it interesting and dark. Where I basically say those theme songs are like the definition of someone fucking going for it. Like, they didn't pull punches. It was not that this will lead to a pop career. It was the pop career. It's the closest my generation has to like Sam Cooke or like Marvin Gaye or Otis Redding at their prime. Like, it's that much passion. And then I act out the examples of how those go. And usually people are like, I know that.
See, that is funny.
There you go.
You're already touching my heart.
I make it an anthropological study every time.
Oh, now it's like, now you're flirting.
Oh, anthropological study? Yeah, that's the like, thing? That's the key word?
That's the key to my heart.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Yeah, ask
what's
a question.
Where do you see all this going? What do you want? What are your goals?
Well, you know, I
meet lots of creative people in this town.
Yeah.
And everybody always has like, oh, I want to do this one. But I was kind of like, well, what's the ultimate? Where is this all going?
Well, you know, it's interesting because it's like I've thought a lot about that in the last couple of years because it's no longer, you know, it's interesting to enter into pursuing your dream. Mm. But I'm so used to being like, but I'm pursuing my dream instead of realizing, oh, this is my profession now. Like, it's not like I have a fallback plan. I've been doing this for 14 fucking years. So it's not like, well, if this comedy thing doesn't work out, I know exactly. Manage a Publix in Wisconsin. Like, it's
right.
This is my industry, so how do I freaking sustain?
Yeah.
And I spent a lot of time obsessed about why I didn't belong and why I didn't fit in instead of realizing that that is my in, is that I have to kind of build, and I hate the freaking phrase, but I have to build a brand. This is the United States of America, and it's about building an idea that I, and where all the cracks that I see that I want to fill, I have to build a brand that fills in all those cracks.
Well, I was just talking today with the guy Tyler Knight. He's like a male performer, but he was talking about like the sort of the big transition is like when you view yourself as a brand versus as a product.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
oh,
and like that's kind of like that. You
and
know,
I think that's where I couldn't reconcile that.
And that's
first.
He said like that's when you become like growing up is essentially when you take control of your image and it's like you are now a brand as opposed to like a product that's being like hired by someone to like perform a thing. It's like when you are like you have like a horizontal, like a lateral reach across everything you're doing.
Right.
You know, and that's like, so that's like the generation of the Kardashians or whatever is this idea of brand building, whether it's like clothing line and perfume and whatever, because it's more like it's promoting almost like kind of a lifestyle or like a point of view.
That's exactly right. It's exactly promoting a point of view.
Yeah.
And an idea.
And an idea.
Like, I can, like, I know what my brand is. Like, I can be like, oh, I'm a very cerebral porn star. You know, like that kind of thing where it's like, if it's cerebral at all, then I can do it and my fans will buy it. They'll not buy it, like, financially, but I mean, like, they'll believe it. They'll feel like it's authentic. They'll be into it. Like, whether it's, like, doing, like, a weird horror movie or whatever, as long as something about it's, like, intelligent. They'll go there.
It's on brand. You know,
yeah, it's like that feeling of like on or off brand.
And I wasn't chasing brand. I was chasing a job for a long
time. Right. Well, I think,
which is why I felt miserable because I was just taking whatever came and feeling like, why am I not getting to this? I'm like, oh, because I didn't really take the damn steering wheel and decide what direction I'm going to go.
But I think that's the real paying your dues in any career is the time that you spend toiling under the like, if I could have control of this, this is what it would look like.
Right.
And it's like you reach a critical, you reach like a terminal velocity with that where you finally go like, fuck it, I'm flying.
And that's,
and it's like you kind of like,
that's the place that I feel like I'm starting to enter.
But you're doing really well. I mean, like,
I'm trying,
being Lily Tomlin's son is like fucking
amazing.
Yeah. Like, oh my God.
But you know, and that's a good thing because it's like I really don't let myself appreciate my achievements.
That's amazing.
When I write out my bio, I'm like, oh, this guy has done a couple things. But I don't see it because I'm me, and I'm still like, but I'm not at this other
place. I know. I think it's the hardest thing as a human being is to just sit back and enjoy the experience of doing things that are...
I won't bore you or get too deep on this, but it's...
I would prefer that you do.
No, you don't, because we could be here for days because of where I'm at.
Teach me, Yoda.
But basically, I understand what you're saying, like 1,000%. It's like I always tell people this crazy story of mine was, it wasn't until I started taking pictures when I was... and had a business cards by the time I was 10 years old. I knew I was going to be a photographer.
And I've seen the photo. It's crazy.
I knew I was going to be a photographer my whole life. And I spent my whole life basically trying to be a photographer. And it wasn't until I was 38, 39 years old when a therapist told me, what are you trying to be a photographer? You are one. And I was like, what? I am one? And it clicked. Yes. All of a sudden it realized after trying for 38 years, oh my God, I am one. And then it was like, then it changed the whole perspective of everything else from that point. Literally changed for me. I was like, oh God, I made that. I hit that mark.
Exactly.
So now,
exactly.
Now I've got to change and do this, this, and this, and this, and this.
And that's where I've gotten. Which is like, oh, I have been doing this. I'm not pursuing this. I've been planting seeds, and now it's time to water them.
Yeah.
And connect the dots.
Exactly.
And grow this beautiful black garden I made.
All right. Well, with that, let's wind it down, and maybe we can have you back for another episode.
Okay. I would love that.
No.
In the meantime, can you tell my listeners how they can find you, follow you, stalk you?
Yes. Listeners, listen. I'm on Twitter. I'm at BARVONBLAQ. I sing it so that way people can kind of get the letters. I also have a podcast called Malton on Movies with Leonard Malton. Well, it's actually called Malton Movies with Baron Vaughn, but I'm Baron Vaughn. But it's with Leonard Malton. It's a movie podcast, just talking movies in intelligent ways. And then Grace and Frankie, which is on Netflix. And otherwise than that, BaronVaughn.com, which hasn't been updated in 2 years, so don't worry about it.
Do you still do stand-up around town?
All the time.
So where should they go to find when they can see you?
I'm probably going to try to headline the Improv again soon. So I do the Improv a lot. I'm a regular at the UCB Franklin and the Virgil and the Meltdown, Meltdown.
Do you update your shows anywhere? Is there like a Tumblr?
I put them on my Twits.
On your Twitter? Okay.
I put them on my Twits, and then I also need to put them on my website as well. But I tweet about pretty much everything I'm doing all the time.
Okay. Cool. Yeah. Awesome. And you all know where to find me on Twitter at Sovereign Sire and on my website, ilovesov.com, which is probably how you got here. Probably. And of course, on this lovely podcast, which is available on iTunes, SoundCloud, as well as on the website. Bye, everybody.